Right, here we are, Didactic Mind, episode 14, For Better or For Worse. Very warm welcome to all of my loyal readers from the blog, very warm welcome to all of my subscribers from SoundCloud, and of course, if you are a new listener, a very warm welcome to you too. If you have not subscribed already, either to the blog posts or to these podcasts here on SoundCloud, please make sure you hit the subscribe button. That way you will always get email updates whenever I post new material or whenever a new podcast goes up. I try to make this a weekly thing. And so far, actually, I've been reasonably successful with a couple of exceptions. Please excuse me if I sound a little hoarse or weird today, and if you hear a couple of explosions, that's actually me, the reason being that I've caught a mild cold, and I'm pretty sure it's because of an old family friend of ours who, you know, my family's known for about, 50 years, something like that, longer actually, probably about 60 years in my mother's case. He visited a couple of days ago, and he was down with a cold of some kind. And, of course, I shook his hand. I was the one serving the food at the gathering. So I'm sure I picked up an infection in the process. It's nothing serious. It's nothing to be overly concerned about. Just a, you know, case of the sniffles and a bit of sneezing, a bit of nasal congestion, the sore throat and all that. That's all mostly gone by now. But the show must go on, of course, so here I am podcasting, even though I would much rather be in bed, frankly. But that being said, the reason why I wanted to make this podcast, and the reason I gave it the title that I did, is because today is a very special day for me, for my family, actually. Today marks, amazingly, the 40th wedding anniversary for my parents. That's right, they've been married 40 years. And that is an astonishing achievement by any standard, at least outside of Asian communities. Because the part of the world that I'm from, you know, marriages for life are pretty much taken for granted. That's how people get married here. The divorce rate in this country is officially 1%. It's the lowest anywhere in the world, at least according to official statistics. In reality, the divorce rate is almost certainly much higher than that. But those are the statistics that we have, so those are the statistics that we'll go with. My personal view is that the divorce rate is closer to 5 to 10%. But that's still vastly lower than the, you know, 50 to 70% divorce rate in Western societies. Excuse me. Sorry about that. Like I said, you'll hear a few of these coughs and sneezes. I do apologize for that. Really, nothing I can do about it other than, you know, try to edit them out a little bit wherever possible. But, you know, that's time-consuming. As I was saying, the problem is that in the West, you have these astonishingly high divorce rates and divorce statistics and separation rates and, you know, broken families and so on and so forth. In Asian societies, you don't have divorce because divorce is considered incredibly shameful and deeply humiliating for all parties involved, and not just for all parties involved, like for the two parties involved, for the two people involved, but for their extended families as well. So divorce is not something to be taken lightly here. And the fact that it is my parents' 40th wedding anniversary today, and the fact that, as I pointed out in last week's podcast, it is absolutely vital to choose your partner in life, your wife, your significant other, as carefully as possible, got me thinking about, you know, what it means to get married and to make a commitment of that kind, you know, how important, how vitally important it is to get it right. This issue of divorce is especially relevant because of recent attention that I've been paying to the MGTOW movement. If you're not aware of MGTOW, it's an acronym, MGTOW, that simply means men going their own way. Now, men going their own way is a movement that's existed since the 1970s, at least, in its earliest form. And what it says is that Western society is so corrupt and so stacked against men in every way that it is better for men not to play the game at all and to simply check out and not to waste their time on women, not to date, not to court, and not to marry women, not to have children with them, but simply to spend men's time and effort doing what is of interest to men, which is to say, traveling the world, building their careers, building their finances, engaging in pursuits that are intellectually interesting to them, and essentially kind of letting the world burn, letting the Western world burn itself out. Now, I am, as my blog posts will tell you, philosophically deeply opposed to the MGTOW movement. I do not agree with it in any way, but I do sympathize with it. And I do understand where they're coming from. I get it. You know, I'm not like the hardline, at least I'm not like many of the hardline members of the hard right, who say that MGTOW guys are totally contemptible and should be regarded as weaklings and at worst traitors and should be simply booted out of the movement completely, out of the right. Completely and totally, because they can only reliably be counted upon to stab you in the back. That's how a lot of the hard right thinks of the MGTOW movement. Now, I understand why the hard right thinks that way, and I also understand why the MGTOW guys think the way they do. It's not hard to understand why the MGTOW guys say marriage is a raw deal, getting married is signing yourself up to like a lamb to the slaughter. You're setting yourself up for failure. You're gonna get divorce raped, and you're gonna lose out because statistically speaking, it's you're facing better than 50% odds that your marriage will collapse. Monogamy is stupid. It's not. It doesn't make sense biologically speaking. Men are wired to be polygamous, to have sex with as many women as possible, to spread our genetic information far and wide. And if you look at the structure of Western society today, if you look at how gynocentric the laws are, which is to say favored bias towards women in divorce court and in terms of alimony and child support, in family court, which is essentially just a losing battlefield for men, what is the point of even showing up to fight? You're going to lose anyway, so why should you even bother getting married? Why should you even take the risk? Why should you even try to start a family? Have children? Do anything to put down any kind of roots? And again, I understand where that point of view comes from. I get it. I used to think the same way for a very long time. If you read my blog posts from 2013, which is when I started the blog, it's hard to believe, but I've been blogging for over 7 years. There aren't very many bloggers out there, relatively speaking, especially on the hard right even, who have been posting for that long. And not only posting, but regularly posting. My blog has been around for 7 years, and there have been almost daily posts on that blog during that entire time. You can go back and look at my blog during that time, and you can say, you know, you can see some of the posts that I wrote, like notes from an Asian wedding, notes from another Asian wedding later on the same year, various posts about how you don't deserve to get married, posts about what it's like to be married from a red pill perspective, so on and so forth. The reason I wrote those posts was because at the time I really thought marriage was not for me, and it's not something that I want to do. It's a loser's game. I thought very much the way MGTOW does. It's a terrible idea to do this, and you're playing against the house, to use a gambling term. But at the same time, I have examples in my own family of people who've been married for decades, and those marriages have, by most conventional measures, been successful. So how do I reconcile the two? It's not just because societal pressure was keeping those marriages intact, because in some of these cases, the marriages were, in Western society, where the ability to divorce a man is much greater, and the social pressure to divorce is not really there. Social pressure is what you make of it. If you want to be influenced by your family and your peers, you will be. If you don't want to be influenced by them, you won't be. You can plot and chart your own course in life. So it's not true that you will simply succumb inevitably to social pressure. Excuse me a moment. I had to go get some nasal spray just now. My sinuses are very badly clogged. The extreme pollution levels in this city really do not help when you've caught a respiratory bug, which I obviously have. If I look at, no, getting back on topic, if I look at my own family, my parents, as I said, have been married 40 years today. My grandparents, before my grandmother died, were married for, let's see, 1947 to 2011, 64 years. They were married for 64 years before my grandmother passed. My father's sister was married to her husband for, ooh, 43, 44 years, something like that. That uncle died last December of lung cancer, of complications related to lung cancer. It's been almost 2 months since he passed. So, if I look at my parents' friends, my dad's best friend from college married 45 years this year. His best friend from business school married 40 something years to, in an arranged marriage as well. If I look at marriage after marriage among my friends, among the circle of my parents' friends, long-term stable relationships and marriages that have lasted decades with at least two children produced in most cases. And generally speaking, they've been productive, happy unions, where the people involved have made their lives work. So is it really true that marriage is a loser's game? I don't think so. I mean, how do I reconcile this view of the Western world, which is unquestionably an utter disaster, with the reality of my own life? And it's not just, I'm not just talking Asian parents or Asian marriages. I'm talking about people from all walks of life. I know of Western families that have been married for decades and decades, happily so. So is it necessarily true that the moment you sign up to get married, you're betting against the house and your odds of a successful marriage, by which I mean a marriage that lasts 10 years or more, preferably 20 years or more, and produces at least two happy children. Let's call that the baseline criterion for a successful marriage, if that's the success criterion. Is it really necessarily true that your odds of achieving that are less than 30%? Is that the case? I'm not at all convinced of that, not anymore. And the longer I look at this idea, the more closely I check on it, the more I think about it, the more I am convinced that it is not true, and that statistically speaking, there's a lot that you can do to reduce your risks, and that it is vitally important for a man to reduce his risks. Now, I went over how to reduce your risks in some detail last week, and I want to go over exactly why those risks are important, or how those risks can be reduced here in this podcast, because this is important. There is a case to be made for marriage and for monogamous marriage. And a lot of that is informed by faith. Now, for those of you who aren't Christian, what I'm going to say on the subject won't mean a damn thing to you, because faith is at the core of everything we do in terms of
how we look at the world. Christians don't look at the world in terms of a lens of fear. We don't look at the world worrying about what could go wrong. We don't look at the world worrying about, you know, whether things will explode in our faces. We look at the world in terms of, we are put in this world to fight evil, okay? We are put here to stand firm against the evil that is sweeping it, sweeping across the entire world and making everybody in its path desperately unhappy, okay? When you look at it through a Christian lens, what is marriage? Marriage is not simply, you know, saying, oh, I love this woman and she loves me. She's never going to divorce me. No, that's not what it is. Marriage is simply saying to the world, do your worst. Do your absolute worst to me because I have hope. I can fight against this because I am not afraid of what you can do to me. So, the importance of that hope lies in the fact that marriage is the manifestation of hope and love. When you love a woman and you commit to her, I mean, you can't really have a committed relationship without marrying. Well, marrying is a sign of respect and love. It's the sign of true commitment. A lot of guys in the modern West are so afraid of marriage and so afraid of getting divorce raped in court and having half their stuff taken away from them more, you know, and losing their children and so on, that they don't commit to relationships anymore because they're like, a committed relationship is dangerous. Or if they commit at all, they will say, oh, you know, I'm not going to commit. I'll just move in with a girl. I'll live with her as a cohabiting couple. Well, quite apart from the spiritual dangers of that, and they are very real, that's not a committed relationship. It's not. The reality is that deep in your mind, there's always the thought that if this doesn't work out, I can walk away. Yeah, I can just say, no, I'm done. You know, this isn't working. Let's just both break up and see other people. It doesn't matter if you've been living together for 10 years. If the sex stops happening, if she gets fat, if you get fat, if you change jobs, you're no longer as attractive as you used to be. You're just bored with life. You're not interested in each other anymore. Your interests grow apart. You no longer find each other fun to be around, so on and so forth. You can both just say, okay, well, that's too bad. We just break up and walk away. With marriage, for a man, you can't do that. For a woman these days, absolutely, you know, society makes it very easy for a woman to just walk away. That's true. Women get cash and prizes for just walking away and saying, I'm not happy anymore, and I don't want to be in this relationship with this guy anymore, so I'm just going to, you know, pull the pin on the grenade and blow up our marriage and walk away. Because I feel like it. Several of my own readers have experienced that. They've experienced a woman who just exploded their entire world in the space of a month or two, or sometimes even less. I mean, our friend, the gentleman adventurer, Adam Piggott, if you're not subscribed to his podcast, then subscribe. He's a devout Christian, a Catholic. He's rediscovered his faith because of what he went through. His wife pulled the pin on their marriage. And Adam himself will tell you, if you ask him, that he did a lot of things wrong in that relationship, even though he fully believed in getting married. He still does. But the balance between him and his wife changed. And that's all I'm going to say on the subject. If you want to know more, ask Adam himself. But, or listen to his podcast, because he goes into detail, you know, as much detail as he can in there. And, you know, his wife basically sold her soul, as Adam himself wrote, She sold her soul to get nice things, and in the process walked away from their marriage, walked away from a lifelong commitment. Women can do that, and it's easy for them to do in this society, because with no-fault divorce, with quick divorces, and with court-mandated alimony and child support payments, it's very easy for them to do. And it's incredibly destructive, because it destroys a man's desire to get married and to have the good things that a marriage brings. Because if you ask yourself why we get married, why is it that men get married, you know, put aside the whole Christian aspect of it for a moment. What is the point of marriage? Marriage is, whether you look at it through an economic lens or a sexual lens or a spiritual lens, a union. In an economic sense, marriages first came about essentially to ensure the continuation of inheritance through bloodlines. The reason why men and women got married was because, formed pair bonding relationships was because with the advent of agriculture and farming and, you know, the move away from nomadic hunter-gatherer tribes, so the social anthropologists tell us, the importance of passing on what is inherited property to the next generation became very important. And marriage became a socially sanctioned way of ensuring that property was passed on properly. If you look at it from a sexual lens, marriage is an incredibly powerful solution to two completely competing reproductive strategies. On the male side, men produce vast amounts of sperm. I mean, billions and billions and billions of them every single day. One man is fully capable of impregnating 10 women in the space of one day. It's easy for us. I mean, you give us a bit of a break in between, you know, over the course of a 24-hour period. One guy could easily bang 10 girls and make them all go, you know, fill them all with babies. It's not that difficult. And he would still be just fine to go do all the other stuff that a man wants to do, you know, for the rest of his time. For us as men, sex is cheap, sex is easy, and sex is kind of absolutely necessary for us, actually. We need to have it, and we feel an extremely powerful biological drive to have it as often as possible, because if we don't have it, you know, we tend to go crazy. Same with women, by the way. Women who don't have sex regularly go crazy. They need it just as much as we do. Sex is not just reproductive for humans, it is also a source of deep pleasure and bonding between two people. But the problem is that the male reproductive strategy involves spreading reproductive material far and wide, as far and as wide as possible. Because for us, sex is cheap, and for us, male lives are cheap. Like I said, one man to 10 women, pretty reasonable ratio. You can get away with that and still keep a society functioning. You know, if you have, I made this illustration on my blog a while back, you know, several years back. There was a catastrophe several, you know, about 100,000 years or something like that, less than that. Basically, if you go look up the Lake Toba catastrophe, Lake Toba is a lake in Sumatra, I believe. I have been there. I've actually personally been to Lake Toba many years ago, and I visited the crater that was left by it. Essentially what happened was an extremely powerful volcanic explosion erupted at Lake Toba. This was, you know, some time ago. Let me go look it up. I have a blog post on it, in fact. If you look at the Lake Toba catastrophe, this was about 75,000 years ago. It is hypothesized by some genetic anthropologists that this was an extinction event never before seen in human history up until that time. Apparently, the theory goes that the entire population of the world was reduced down to about 10,000 individuals, 10,000 people. That's it. That explosion was so titanic that it caused the world to enter into a new ice age, and resulted in a climactic shift that more than decimated human populations everywhere. It is said that the total number of breeding men in that sample set of about 10,000 people was less, from what I've heard, less than 3,000 men out of 10,000. I think about that for a moment. One in three were men that were left over after this catastrophe. Again, this is speculative. We don't know if this is true. We don't have definitive proof that this is true. I have been to Lake Toba. I can tell you, having seen the sheer size of the caldera that was left, in the modern day, that the explosion that resulted could easily have caused a cataclysmic extinction event of the kind that is described. I can believe it. No problems. I spent a lot of time in the Ring of Fire during my youth. I know what these volcanic eruptions can do. So when people say that it was, many, 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 many times worse than Krakatoa, or than the explosion at Vesuvius, or the explosions at Mount Merapi, which happen on a regular basis these days, I can well believe it. The entire population of the world today supposedly can be traced back to just that handful of human beings, and just a tiny handful, relatively speaking, of men. Why? Because, again, sperm is cheap. For women, their breeding strategies are totally different. For men, men want to go out and have sex with as many women as we can. For women, they have one egg every month. They are born with, about 100,000 eggs. But the vast majority of these will never, ever go from being follicles to actual eggs. They, from the time that they hit puberty to the time they hit menopause, they produce one egg every month, and they have a very limited time window in which to mate and become pregnant, conceive, carry a baby to term, which is an enormously difficult thing to do for a woman. It is incredibly costly, incredibly challenging. It's a huge drain on her physically and emotionally, and very painful. Childbirth is extremely painful for a woman. So, given these facts, a man's strategy is to have sex with as many women as he can to ensure the continuation of his genetic material, because men's lives are cheap. Men aren't necessary, in large numbers for propagation of the species. You only need a handful of men to propagate the entire human race. So one individual man isn't important. Therefore, to secure the maximum chance of his genetic line carrying through into the future, he wants to have sex with as many women as possible. A woman's strategy is diametrically opposed to that. She wants to find a high-quality man who can ensure the genetic survival, or the maximum genetic potential of her offspring. And she doesn't have much of a chance to get that guy. From the time that she hits puberty, so let's say 13 or 14, let's say she starts being sexually active after the age of consent, which, depending on where you are, is 16 to 18, right? Let me make it very clear, I am not advocating for any kind of relations below the age of consent. Never will, never have. That should be obvious, right? As far as I'm concerned, if a woman over the age of consent is having sex, that's the starting point for her, okay? Up until she hits menopause, she's going to produce only a handful of eggs. And by the time she's 30 years old, the hard, painful reality is that 90% of all the eggs that she is capable of producing have been produced or are dead, okay? She's never going to produce more than those eggs that she has available. And over the course of her lifetime, she'll produce, what, about 400 eggs. That's it. 400. And most of those, 99% of those, pretty much, will never be used. So 99.999% of a woman's eggs will never be used. All of this comes at a tremendous psychological and physical cost to a woman. So to mitigate this, she is going to seek out the maximum value reproductive partner that she can find, the one with the most resources, the most strength, the most ability to protect her and her children from danger. You know, this is not new to anybody, or at least it shouldn't be to anybody who's red pill aware. So marriage then becomes a way of reconciling these completely competing and different strategies. With the male strategy, he now has an assured genetic continuation, or pretty close to assured. He now has access to one sexually available, hopefully fertile woman who will have sex with him regularly and will produce offspring, which means that his genetic line and its continuation is more or less assured. The woman now has access to a man's resources and protection. A man trades his resources for a woman's sex and for children. It's a very powerful idea and a very powerful trade, and it is the fundamental basis upon which all civilization rests. You cannot have a civilized society without this fundamentally vital pairing, this pair bonding of one man and one woman coming together to create new life, to educate that life, to carry it to term, to civilize it, to raise it in the right way so that it too can go on and continue this tradition. Now, that's the sexual and economic aspects taken care of. The spiritual aspect I'll discuss very briefly, and it comes back to Christianity, you know, this idea of one man and one woman joining two souls together to create one new soul, one new life. This is a very powerful and wonderful thing. When you look at things just through cold genetics or sexual behavior, you take away the really powerful aspect of pair bonding. Spiritually speaking, when a man has sex with a woman, he leaves part of his soul behind with her, and she leaves a much bigger part of her soul with him. And for those of you who are atheists or agnostic, this won't mean a damn thing to you. I get that. You know, it's fine. I mean, I didn't understand it when I was in your place. Okay. You'll just kind of have to take my word for it. This is the case. So if this is what happens, then a woman really is much better off finding one man with whom to bond for the rest of her life and to share her soul with. And the man is much better off cooling his passions and cooling his desires and binding himself to one woman in order that these passions may be tamed, that the flesh may become sated and may become yielding to the power of the spirit. Because while the flesh is corrupted and broken and weak, the spirit, when it is given nourishment and light and life, is far more powerful. And when you combine the spirit of a man, the soul of a man and a woman together, merge together with the healing power, the binding force of the Holy Spirit, then wonderful things can happen. But it's up to each of them to let those things happen, and it is very, very difficult for it to work even in those cases, because again, the flesh is weak. Okay. So marriage is, for a number of reasons, whether you're talking practical reasons, sexual reasons, spiritual reasons, an incredibly powerful and wonderful thing. And it is to society's great detriment that that marriage has become trivialized and cheap. Where then do we proceed from here? If marriage is so wonderful, and I do think it is, because the examples and role models I have in my life tell me that it is worth pursuing, and it is a good idea despite the risks, and the risks are severe. Okay, what are we going to do about it? What is a man to do about his desire to get married when in the face of a society that wants him to fail? Well, this is where risk mitigation comes in very, very handy. Now, as I pointed out in one of my posts from some time ago, it's a post called, there's a post called Fighting the Zombie Plague, and this was from June 2019, so about 6 months ago. I had a look at some statistics put together by another blogger called Free Northerner. Free Northerner's blog is one that I used to read on a daily basis. I don't know where what he's up to now. I haven't read any of his work in a long time. But he did put together some interesting statistics, and these are worth going through. If you look at the numbers, they are very telling. Age of first sexual experience on the part of the woman. If it's greater than 18, then your odds of divorce are between 32 and 38%. 17 to 18 jumps to 47%, 15 to 16 to 59%, 13 to 14, 72%, and younger than 12, God help us, because that's horrifying, 82%. Number of prior sexual partners for the woman, 0, odds of divorce, 20%, 1, odds of divorce, 46%. Now look at that. Think about that for a moment. The moment you have marry a woman with just one prior sexual partner, her odds of divorce go up by more than double. They go up by basically 120%, thereabouts. Yeah, 130% actually. 130% jump just because of one sexual partner. Think about that. Number of prior sexual partners, 2 to 4, 56 to 60% chance of divorce. 5 to 15, 70% chance of divorce. Age of first marriage, less than 18, 48% chance of divorce. 18 to 19, 40% chance of divorce. 20 to 24, 29% chance. 25 plus, 24% chance. Time of first birth, before marriage, 67% chance of divorce. 0 to 7 months after, 59% chance. 8 months after, 32% chance. Education, which is tightly correlated with IQ. Bachelor's degree, 22% chance. Some college, 51% chance. High school, 59% chance. Lower than high school, 61%. Race and ethnicity. Asian, 31% chance. White, 46%. Hispanic, 47%. Black, 63%. Parents. Two parents in the family, 42% chance of divorce. Non-intact family, 62% chance of divorce. If you're raised religiously, if you're a Catholic, about a 50% chance of divorce, is actually 47%. Protestant, 50%. Other, 35%. No religion, 57%. And then it goes into, you know, deep breakdowns of, you know, what happens by religion. If you cohabitated with your husband before marriage, then your odds of divorce, if you're a woman, go up to 55% chance. If you did not cohabitate, 43% chance. Effect of wife's share of total income on divorce risk. If she earns 0 to 20% of the income, it's a multiplier of 1. But the more of the share of the income that she earns, the higher the multiplier of divorce risk really jumps up radically. So, you know, if she's earning 40 to 60% of the income, then it's 1.62 times multiplier. And if you're in, as you go up in terms of income, that acts as a decreasing factor, actually, I guess. the right word for it escapes me, but it's a reduction in the risk. The multiplier actually reduces the risk associated. So, you know, if you're in the lowest income quartile, your risk of divorce is like a one-time 1x multiplier. But if you're in the highest income, it's 0.92 times multiplier. So you can see the trends here. I mean, it's very straightforward to explain. Basically, if you're a man, you should be educated, or you should be aiming to get some kind of education. You should aim to earn much more money than your prospective wife. You should aim to marry her sometime between, you know, when she's over the age of, when she's about the age of 25 or so, which is a 20 to 25 thereabouts is probably your best time to marry her. You should not be cohabitating with her before marriage. If you do cohabitate with her, you damn well better make sure that she's the right woman. You should try to marry within your own race. Even if you marry interracially, there are certain pairings that are much more successful than others. So, for instance, Asian woman with white man tends to be very successful. Very, very low chance of divorce involved. Black woman with white man tends to have a very low risk of divorce. But black man with a white woman tends to jack up the risk of divorce significantly. Black and Asian pairings don't seem to do very well at all. All of these factors play in. And when you look at this, the spectrum of factors, they are quite large. The MGTOW crowd keeps harping on and on and on about how divorce is, you know, inevitable. You're almost certainly going to get divorced because look at the odds. I mean, 50%, 70%. You're throwing out these crazy numbers here. No woman in the current environment has had less than 5 cocks by the time she's left college. I mean, I've dated girls who have slept with, in the case of that Ukrainian woman, I don't even know how many guys, but it was a lot. And, you know, there are lots and lots of women out there who have had sex with a lot of guys. There are lots of women out there these days who identify as bisexual. This is not a good thing. I'm not for a moment saying it's a good thing. But that doesn't mean that you have to marry these sleuths. You're not being forced to marry them. Just because this is the dreck that's available on the dating market in your city does not mean that you are stuck having to deal with this. You have options. You can do things about this. You can make changes. You can come up with alternatives that are more appealing than what you've got right now. So how do you go about mitigating your risk? How do you get to the point where you can actually boast about having a 40-year-long marriage or a 64-year-long marriage or a 70-year-long marriage? How do you get to the point where you can actually be one of those couples that you read about in the newspapers where very touchingly, very sweetly, and very sadly, the wife dies and the husband dies, you know, just days or even hours or sometimes just minutes after his wife passes because they just love each other so much. They've been so close for so long. Their souls are bound together. They don't want to leave each other. How do you reconcile? How do you get to that point? Well, the numbers, for one thing, which the MGTOW crowd love to spread and use to spread their misery, the numbers tell you exactly how to do it. Marry within your own race, or if you must marry outside of it, marry in a relatively stable pair bonding way. Marry a woman who is roughly at your education level. Preferably, you are a little bit more educated than she is. Marry a woman where you are definitively earning most of the income. Marry a woman who is preferably between the ages of 20 to 25, because that's when she's at her most energetic, her most fertile. She'll be actually interested in having children. Marry a woman from an intact family. And she's marry someone whose parents have a good relationship with each other. Marry a woman who is intelligent and interesting and who you can actually spend time with, that you would like being around. Marry a woman who is religious, or at least has some kind of faith to her, who takes Christianity at least somewhat seriously. Marry a woman who understands how to be domesticated, understands domestic skills. Marry a woman who isn't interested in a career or, you know, just working her ass off. Most of all, the single most important quality you have to look for, gentlemen, is loyalty. Is she a loyal person? Is she the kind of person who will help out her friends no matter what? Is she the kind of person who never abandons her friends? Is she the kind of person who, when you're hurting and you're feeling down and weak and tired, is she the kind of person who'll stand by you? Is she the kind of person, is she the kind of woman who, when things are really bad for you and you're facing setback after setback, everything's going wrong for you, you know, the whole world is against you, you have nowhere else to turn to, is she the one who comes along and says to you, hey, listen, it's going to be okay. It's going to be all right. Don't worry. We're going to find a way through this together. Is she the one who acts as your support and your lifeline, your beacon when you're lost at sea? Is that the woman that you're with? If so, and you've considered all of these other factors and you've said, yeah, okay, I've weighed up the risks, I've weighed up the positives and negatives. Yeah, okay, maybe she slept with more guys than I would like, and maybe she's older than I would like. But if I look at what she's doing right now, you know, is she educated? Yeah, she is. Is she interested in having a career? No, she's not. Does she have a long history of stable relationships with the men she's with? Yes, she does. Does she know what she wants? Yes, she does. Does she cook? Does she clean? Yes. Is she compatible with me? Is she? Does she and I share similar interests? Yes. Okay. You know, why wait? Why mess about? Why waste her time? Adam Piggott, again, you know, pointed out in one of his 28 true rules for the modern man. Don't ever date a girl for more than 6 months if you don't intend on marrying her. Why would you do that? I mean, what's the point? Don't waste her time, don't waste yours. All you're doing, if you hold out for a girl for longer than that, you know, if you're with a girl for longer than that, is you're just afraid of being alone. You don't want to be alone, so you'd rather be in a relationship with a girl that you know, at some level, you're not going to marry, rather than saying, okay, you know what, let's call time on this. You go your own way, I'll go mine. Let's both find other people with whom we'd be more compatible. Instead of doing that, you're wasting her time, and she doesn't have the time to waste. So stop doing it. Go out there, find the girl who is interesting enough and stable enough and cute enough and fertile enough and happy enough and secure enough that you don't mind dealing with some of the craziness that comes with her from time to time, because she is going to be crazy. All women are crazy. All of them. Every single one. You're not going to find a non-crazy woman. Not going to happen. So now that you found this woman, you know, eventually after much searching and looking, and by the way, if you're a Christian, hopefully without fornicating in the process, hopefully. I mean, I'm not going to pass judgment on you if you do. You'll have to answer for it same way that I will and same way that everyone else will. If you've done it, then that's on you. But if you found a girl that you think meets your criteria and you get married and you make it work somehow, you find a way to live together and be together and have children, hey, that's wonderful. That's fantastic. Good luck to you. I mean, that's tremendous news. I have a reader whose wife recently gave birth to their third child. That is just amazing, wonderful news. I'm so happy for whoever it was. I forget. Robert D. Wood, I think it was, the commenter. And it's just, you know, how can you not be happy about that? At the same time, be aware that as time goes by, the attraction will fade. The lust and the desire will fade. And that's when things tend to get a little problematic. Now, what I'm going to relate is not necessarily based on what I've seen in any marriages that I know. I'm just, like, at least not in any close marriages like that I am directly have any insight into. I'm just saying that this is what I've observed as general trends. So this is not, I want to make it clear, this is not in any way a reflection on anyone that I know. I'm not saying that I'm, you know, coloring anything into these comments from marriages that I have seen in my own family. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying that this is what I've observed as general trends from looking at marriages around the world from many different stages in life. So physical passion will fade after a while, and that's a very bad thing. Husbands, love your wives and do not be harsh with them. Ephesians, right? That's in Ephesians itself, in the Bible, and there's a very good reason for it. Wives must submit to their husbands, but husbands must love their wives and not be harsh with them. Husbands should revel in the beauty of their wives. I was reading Proverbs earlier today, and in Proverbs, Solomon, King Solomon, makes it very clear that the path of an adulterous woman is incredibly dangerous. An adulteress will come to you, you know, speaking honeyed words and telling you wonderful things and making you feel like you're the most amazing man alive, tempting you away from your wife. But you're going to find that the moment you lie with her, she is poison, and she has poisoned you and disgraced you when what you should have been doing was finding joy and bliss in the breasts of your wife. And that's actually what it says. I mean, in Proverbs, it actually says right there, a husband should, the sight of, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, obviously, the sight of his wife's breasts should fill a man with great joy and make him feel very happy. Now, that's true. I mean, it is. It's self-evidently true. A man should really feel great desire for his wife. And to maintain that desire is essential for a happy marriage. The marriages that I have seen that have lasted for decades and decades tend to fall in one of two categories. Either the two involved are still very much in love, and while they may not be physically passionate exactly, they are still really happy to be around each other. They sit together and they laugh and they chat and they exchange silly commentary between each other, and they love to be together. They are lovebirds, effectively. They're just laughing and chatting and just enjoying each other's company. They are happy to be around each other. They are happy people to be around. And then on the other end of the spectrum, there are the people who have just been together for so long that they're just comfortable being together. There's no physical passion between them. They never exchange any physical affection. They never show significant desire for each other. And it begins to show because, you know, the husband becomes very grumpy and short-tempered. The wife becomes very negative and deeply unhappy, and she suppresses a lot of anger and anxiety. And it shows in both of them. They both become lazy. They both become very set in their ways. They never want to change anything. They always want to embrace only their most comfortable routines. They don't want to try anything much new. They're just boring people to be around. And in many cases, unfortunately, in the case of the woman especially, this frustration, this lack of happiness, this lack of desirability manifests itself in dramatic weight gain. And it's just awful to watch that happen. This has been the case in a number of marriages that I have seen, and it's a tragedy when it does happen. So the admonition to prospective husbands is very simple. Keep yourself in shape. Make sure that you remain desirable, not just to your wife, but to other women. Now, that's important. It's not a nice thing to say, but it's true. As a Christian, especially, your focus should be on your wife. Absolutely. That doesn't mean you can let yourself slack in the physical fitness department. You don't get to attract a beautiful woman by being physically a crappy specimen. If you want to maintain your wife's attraction to you, you have to put in the effort, which means you have to be fit, strong, healthy, still capable of commanding her respect simply through your physical presence. You can't do that, don't get married. More than that, physical passion is absolutely vital, which means, husbands, you should be having regular sex with your wives. It's just that simple. By all means, do whatever you want to do in the bedroom. I mean, that's between you and your wife. Carry on as you wish. And may God bless you in all of your variety. But make sure that she understands you have intense physical desire for her. Because there's nothing that makes a woman happier than to see the man that she loves consumed with physical passion for her, no matter how she looks. You know, that's not quite true. No matter how long she's been married to him, if she looks ugly and awful, and she, you know, she's 50 pounds overweight and smells bad and has hair growing out of various orifices, and is just awful to look at, then no husband's going to be attracted to that. But if a husband who puts in the time and effort to maintain himself and stays looking good, stays in good shape, continues to be desirable to other women, continues to be a leader in his community, if that guy says, "Hey, honey, I wish you would lose some weight. I love you very much. I want to be physically intimate with you, but I can't do it right now because you just don't look very good. Let's get together and let's see if we can make things happen. Let's see if we can restore the sparks." If that happens, then that's the way it should be. Like if she takes that hint, then she will hopefully put herself back in line. So, those are my thoughts about marriage. I mean, we're running out of time here on the podcast, and I have to make a call before I get some sleep. But basically, my advice to young men everywhere is, don't give in to despair. Don't follow the counsel of the MGTOWs. As well-meaning as they might be, they don't want to fight. They don't want to show up for the battle. They don't believe in fighting for civilization. So stop following their advice. They are well-meaning in their own way. Many of them have been crushed and beaten and brutalized by the system, which I understand completely because I've felt the same thing. And it's absolutely awful when you have to go through it. But they're not interested in fighting anymore. I am. Men like me are interested in fighting. And we're going to keep fighting. So join the fight. Revel in the fight. Conflict is the very air we breathe. It is the water that we drink. It is the food that we eat. It is everything that defines us as men, to quote our beloved and dreaded Supreme Dark Lord, Vox Dei. So, things to think about, and I hope this was thought-provoking for you. If it was, please feel free to leave a comment either here at SoundCloud or back in my blog, and I will see you on the next one.